ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID, the Future, we hear the first segment of three in a conversation hosted by philosopher Pat Flynn, speaking with biochemist and intelligent design pioneer Michael Behe, along with Flynn's co-host Jim Madden. It's science and philosophy meeting to discuss how far science can take us in understanding the markers of design in nature.
Okay, welcome back to the Pat Flynn Show, everyone. We are joined once again by our regular guest, Dr. Jim Madden, and our somewhat regular guest at this point, Dr. Michael Behe. This is probably your third or fourth time on the show. It's always good to have you, so thanks for coming back on.
Thanks.
My pleasure. Always a good conversation here.
Yeah, so this one, I think this one will be a little bit different. So, you know, we've covered many different aspects of your work on the podcast before, Dr. Behe, and it's always fascinating. We've had a couple of debates, and I thought they've certainly been interesting and many times fruitful as well. But before we dive in, is there anything that you've been working on recently, or any just kind of updates on the stuff you've been researching or writing about?
No, mostly I've been, you know, cutting the grass and, you know, tending the yard and things like that. So nothing newsy on the ID front.
Excellent. Right. Excellent. Good. Yeah. The case is closed then. It's all settled.
Mike, do you still teach?
Yes, I do. I'm still a full-time faculty at Lehigh University. Okay. I teach biochemistry, physical biochemistry.
Excellent. Cool. I assume very well tenured.
I have been for a while. I got tenure before I wrote Darwin's Black Box.
I was just saying, I suspect that's coming very handy.
Well, before we dive in and see where this conversation develops, which will be very interesting. Mike, why don't, for people who might be new and to your work who haven't heard of you before, do you mind a sort of brief introduction and whatever you think are the relevant things for people to know about the work you've done in the world of ID?
Okay, yeah. I received a PhD in biochemistry way back in 1978. I did research on sickle cell hemoglobin, did a postdoc at the National Institutes of Health on the structure of DNA and chromatin, got a job in the chemistry department of Queens College, and then moved to Lehigh University in 1985. And during all this time, I thought Darwinian evolution was a good explanation, not because I knew how it could explain the complex systems that are seen in biochemistry, but because that's what I was taught by my instructors, and I didn't care. And I'm a Catholic, like yourselves, and I was taught about Darwinian evolution in parochial school, and we were told essentially that God can make life however he wants to, and this looks like a good explanation for it. That sounded fine by me. I didn't care. And so my work wasn't on evolution or anything related to that until in the late 1980s, I read a book called Evolution, a Theory in Crisis by a geneticist named Michael Denton in Australia, and he pointed out a number of problems for Darwin's theory that I had never thought about before and had never been mentioned in any of the classes that I took, you know, going up to and past the PhD level, and I didn't have answers for them. And at that point, I got mad because I thought I was being led to believe something, not because the evidence for it was compelling, but just because that's the way we were supposed to think these days. Mm-hmm. And so from then on, I became very interested in the claims of Darwinian evolution. And I went to the science library and found that, in fact, nobody in all of the scientific literature had explained complex biochemical systems, a number that I have discussed in my books since then. And kind of serendipitously, I came to write some books on the topic. First one was Darwin's Black Box that highlighted the, well, again, the very complex biochemical systems that have been discovered in the cell, and showed that nobody has been, none of them have been explained by Darwinian processes, and why they resist Darwinian explanation too. And I've written two further books, and I'll skip the second one, but the final one just came out 2 years or so ago, and it's called Darwin Devolves. And the kind of new twist there is that due to advances in science, we can now more easily track down the mutations that help organisms to adapt and survive in new environments. And they do. Mutations do come along, do help them adapt. But the great majority of cases are mutations that break or degrade pre-existing genes. And that sometimes helps, just like it would help to get rid of weight. Maybe the doors on your car or the hood of your car, if you wanted to get better gas mileage, it's not as attractive, but if your survival depended on getting better gas mileage, you could do that. Right. And so I've been in this game a long time, and I become more convinced as time goes along.
Excellent. So Jim, you're kind of the, this is the first time that you've been in this type of roundtable. So I want to kick it over to you and see where you want to maybe guide this conversation or direct some questions to Mike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was in graduate school when the intelligent design thing kind of really took off in the late 90s and the early 2000s. Right. I wrote my dissertation on teleological explanation. That was kind of, I didn't write on intelligent design, but it was kind of like, if there had been a sixth chapter, it probably would have gone in that direction. Uh-huh. So early on, a lot of the stuff I wrote and thought about, I think my first couple publications were on intelligent design. I haven't really thought about it very deeply since probably like the early 2000s. But, my relationship to it has always been interesting, but not with a big dog in the race, right? So my approach to natural theology is very different than the design argument. It's not necessarily that intelligent design is even making a design argument, right? But there's one, and it's kind of the stock objection, right, that you hear to intelligent design. And you may have, done this in your latter two books. I've not read those two books, right? So I'd love to hear your take on this objection, right? If you don't mind. Yeah. Okay. So you'll hear this all the time where whatever complex system we point to, such that to say that there's an incremental explanation, evolution by increments explanation of that becomes so improbable as to strain credulity, right? And it's usually kind of the form of an intelligent design type argument, right? And then usually the reply you'll hear is, well, sure, that just means we don't know the explanation. It doesn't mean that there isn't one, and science always works, at the edges of where explanation seems to break down, and that's where the advance of science is, right? And so it seems to me that the stock objection I always hear to intelligent design is simply that it's a hasty move from a lack of an explanation to a claim that there therefore is not one, so we would have to go beyond science to get that explanation, right? Okay. I'd like to hear your reply, and even do you see that as a fair objection to what you're doing, right?
No, I don't. I think it's a confusion. It begs the question.
Okay.
That assumes that intelligent design is not the answer.
Right.
It says, your intelligent design idea, we want a real answer. Well, sorry, that is the real answer. Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example of another phenomenon in science that had sort of a similar reception, and that's the Big Bang theory. Yeah. back in the day. And then in 1930s, of course, up until then, most physicists thought that the universe was eternal and unchanging. And then the motions of galaxies away from each other and away from the Earth was noted. And that was the beginning of the Big Bang theory. And of course, that seemed to imply that the universe had a beginning, which had very theistic overtones. Maybe that was creation. A lot of physicists did not like that. And they wrote about it. And a number of them said that the Big Bang is unscientific. Science requires that the universe be eternal. Nonetheless, despite opposition, the Big Bang seemed to be consistent with the observations, with the data. And so it seemed to be a legitimate hypothesis. If you see things rushing away from a similar point, then, hey, that looked like the aftermath of an explosion. And that idea still is resisted by many scientists. In the late 1980s, in the journal Nature, which of course is the most prominent science journal in the world, the editor wrote an editorial with a peculiar title. It was called Down with the Big Bang, in which he wrote that the Big Bang is a creationist theory, and that he looked forward to the next 10 years when the Big Bang would be overthrown. Well, that didn't come to pass. But the point is that, the point is that, you know, if you rule something out based on your philosophical preferences, you know, that is not, that's not legitimate. You know, science is supposed to follow the evidence wherever it leads. If it leads in one direction that seems to have some philosophical implications, well, we're scientists, we're not philosophers. If it goes another direction, has different philosophical implications, well, again, we're just supposed to follow the data. So that's the way I kind of view intelligent design.
Right. So, just real quick, just for the gentle listeners, as well, I think it's, and I think you would agree with this, Mike, is that it's really important that we don't stay too abstract with this, because the details seem to matter significantly for the argument, right? And so I wrote a paper, kind of, I showed it to you, Mike, where I was responding to Paul Draper's kind of evolution by letters, but it's like, that's not really how this works, right? It's not just moving letters around. Like, there's a lot of detail here that we have to consider to give this a fair shake. So tell me if you think this summary is fair, Mike, and then clean up however you want. Is that, so you're known for the argument from irreducible complexity, right? Especially in the sort of in your special field of microbiology, right? That there's these systems, right? And the systems that are complex and function only when all the parts exist and are specifically arranged, right? And that if you remove any one of these parts, then the whole system is kaput, right? And the reason this poses a problem is that, say there's, I don't know how many parts there are exactly, but there's a great number of parts, right, that we would have to get to. And there's a coordination problem where the parts have to coordinate to a specific function. And then there seems to be maybe not a logical impossibility, but a virtual impossibility of how we could ever select to that, right? Like how you could ever get to that point through a Darwinian process, that I think it would be fair to say, like, if the Darwinian theory was true, then like irreducibly complex systems would be virtually impossible. But it seems like there's a ton of them in biological life. So it would seem like, you know, Darwin's theory itself is virtually impossible. Is that a fair summary? And if so, maybe you could just fill in some of the details so we can move away from the evolution by letter and just see like the stuff we actually have to deal with. Because I think that makes a significant difference in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. It turns out that, in my view, Darwin's theory does best when you don't look too closely. And back when Darwin proposed it, everybody should remember that science was much, much less sophisticated than it is today. The cell was thought to be a little glob of protoplasm, maybe some sort of jelly. They didn't know how it worked. Atoms and molecules.
Explanation without structure is interesting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Atoms and molecules were theoretical entities. Nobody knew whether they really existed or not. And with the progress since Darwin's age, we, of course, discovered that atoms and molecules are foundational building blocks of things, that the cell is far from just a simple blob of jelly. It's a coordinated factory with all sorts of impressive equipment. And it has been the very progress of science that has made the intelligent design argument more and more and more compelling, in my view, not only in showing the complexity and the purpose of many systems in the cell, but also, as I write in Darwin Devolves, showing that Darwin's mechanism of random mutation and natural selection tends to degrade cells and systems over time. Because since evolution cannot see ahead, it will take the quickest fix that works for the moment with no thought of the future. And oftentimes that involves throwing overboard stuff that, you know, is pretty sophisticated, and just living for the next day. And while that's fine, it can help species adapt to this or that niche, it is not something that's going to build complex machinery in the first place. So the more we know, contrary, you know, it's oftentimes ID is called an argument from ignorance. But the more we know, the more compelling intelligent design becomes.
All right, yeah, Jim, hop back in.
And so, in your later work, what do you see as the conclusion of the argument? Yeah, you know, so the premise is irreducible complexity. And the fact of the matter of how wildly improbable it is to get that, right? What do you see then? Like, what is that? What's the inference to then from those premises?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, irreducible complexity has two major points to it, two edges of disorder or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because it's irreducible, there's machinery in the cell that's irreducible, just like a mousetrap needs all of its parts to work. It resists the gradual step-by-step explanation that Darwin's theory insists upon. And the second thing is that an irreducibly complex system that does something points strongly to design, because design, or the work of a mind, is apprehended in the purposeful arrangement of parts. When you see something here and something here put into relationship so that they can do something beyond themselves, that is the signature of a mind. Think of a mousetrap. It's irreducibly complex because if you take away a part, it breaks. But more than that, all of the parts have been put into relationship with each other so that it can do its function. And I, more and more, I've been kind of focusing on this, that the only way that we can detect the work of a mind is through this purposeful arrangement of parts. We do it when we speak. We arrange sounds so that they can convey a purpose. We do it when writing. We do it when we make a machine. We arrange things for a purpose. And now we see this in spades in the cell. And so the simple idea of ID is that we can conclude the same thing. We can conclude that those things were purposely arranged. They are the work of a mind. Now, as I've said a number of times, intelligent design as a science only has the evidence to go that far. Who the designer is, how it was designed, when it was designed, and so on, those are still open questions. They might be able to be answered in a scientific fashion, but they're still open. It turns out that if you think something is designed, that's the first thing you think about it. You look at a Mount Rushmore, and if you don't know who did it or when it was done or anything, you know it was designed. And those other questions only arise once you think that something was designed. So my take on the biochemistry, the conclusion is that those things were designed. Now we can ask the other questions.
Right. Let me just a few other points of clarification that I think are always important and common stumbling blocks. The first one is that in your critique, at least anyways, of evolution, Mike, it's not, we always have to emphasize that evolution is sort of an accordion term, right? It constantly expands and contracts depending on who's using it of what it means, right? And, you know, there's certain aspects of evolutionary theory, which I think that you affirm, like common descent and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is it's the mechanism. It's the mechanism that's purported to drive it. That's what I'm challenging, right? So I just want to put that out there. Other people might deny other aspects. That's fine, but that's a different conversation. You're saying, no, it's the mechanism that's under critique here, right? Then the other thing go ahead.
Just to add that, it's one word in Darwin's theory, and it's random mutation plus natural selection. And for my money, all or 99.9% of the philosophical and theological and scientific impact of Darwin's theory is in that one word. That is, can random processes, ones that aren't directed by anyone, specifically including God, can they be sifted by some process like natural selection and yield the immense complexity and elegance and all sorts of stuff that we find in biology? This stuff about common descent or other things, that's kind of a sideshow. It's the randomness. And if I can make a point about Jim's early paper, I think I read one of his earliest papers after graduate school, and at the one of the final footnotes in the paper.
Oh my gosh!
I'm sure you
this thing
it.
Up, yeah.
Mike's thorough. If you've read his books, you'll see he's thorough. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah,
well, this is actually a common point. It's not only yourself, Jim, but Steve Barr, a physicist and a guy who's active in Catholic academic circles, holds a similar point. They say, you know, let's separate the neutral Darwinian theory from this atheistic materialistic view of Darwin's theory. In the atheistic materialistic Darwin's theory, people say, oh, this shows that God wasn't involved, or this shows that only the matter and energy and laws of nature are sufficient to explain stuff. But in the good, I think you said philosophically naive Darwin's theory, that just says, oh, you know, it's random, but you know, does not make these other claims, well, that might have worked, or that might be a good theory of evolution. And I could say a couple things about that. First is that everybody in the world, especially in the scientific world, uses Darwin's theory, the phrase Darwin's theory, to mean no guidance by nobody including God. As a matter of fact, in 2005, there was a group of 35 Nobel Prize winners who took out a full page advertisement in the New York Times specifically saying that by evolution, we meet in an unguided, unintelligent process of whatever. So they specifically mean that. And the phrase Darwinian evolution, Darwinian, can have any meaning they apply to it. It's not like saying, it's not like applying a non-proper name to it. And by that, they do mean this other more objectionable take. I appreciate the fact that Steve Barr and stuff want to convert the world to thinking of that phrase as somewhat more benign, but I don't think one can. And the second very important point is that there's no difference between the two, between the benign one and the non-benign one, because in the non-benign one, it's saying that that random mutations, yeah, okay, they're just random. We can't figure out what they are. They, when sifted by natural selection, can build the eye, can build the flagellum, can build anything. So even if you give God, you know, gravity and say electromagnetism, but say, the question is, beyond gravity and electromagnetism, did God have anything to do with life? And you say, well, maybe not, because Darwin's theory seems to account for it. What you are saying then is that accidents, unplanned mutations sifted by natural selection, say the type of mutations that you get when you live in New Jersey next to a chemical factory that lead to birth defects and cancer and stuff, those things, every now and again, those can add up to eyeballs and flagella and so on. What's more than that, you're saying if you have this substratum, then chance can take over from there, and there is no need for intelligence to explain the very phenomenal things that are discovered in life. To me, that seems, that doesn't sound good, because if you have a system that exhibits finality, purpose, and so on, the greater the finality, the more you should be able to say this exhibits purpose, this required design. But if you can't tell that an eyeball was designed, how can you tell that light was designed, or that the photon or electron was designed? The laws of nature are much more general. Things in biology are much more specific. So I think one can have greater case for design in biology than in physics or natural lower natural laws.
So,
Michael, do you think that you could say what we mean by random is relative to how high order perspective we're taking? So you could say something, given the epistemic tools available, or even maybe even like the rules of the game at biochemistry, something will come up random, meaning like we don't have explanatory resources to give an in-principle explanation of this event at this level. Though at a higher order, we could see it's not in fact random at all, right? So at the biochemical level, it's random, but if we could look at it from a broader level, at the chemical level, in fact isn't, or something like that, right? And so it seems like, to me, I've always thought about randomness in biology, or in evolutionary theory, to say, yeah, it's within the rules of the game that are frequently the way that science is played, right? I don't mean to be flippant by saying playing, right? Okay. But given the standard rules of the game, this is going to come up random, meaning there is in principle no per se explanation for what's going on there.
However, that doesn't mean it's uncaused, and it doesn't mean there isn't a teleology to it, though that teleology might only be accessible from a higher order discipline, say, you know, metaphysics or something like that. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Uh-huh. Well,
if I may also, and I think like people who want to go from randomness in that sense to infer ergo unguided, well, that's invalid, right? Okay, by all means, right? But also I think to say, well, to broker randomness there means you're going to have to go the route of, you know, what, what's his name? Nagel calls, you know, the atheistic materialist Darwinist perspective, right? Which he thinks is defunct, right? Do you know what I mean? I think there's kind of a bad inference to be made in both directions there if we take too substantively what's meant by random.
Well, random means that it's undirected. Random mutations, biologists use that to mean it's undirected for the good of the organism.
Right.
That it's just happens, and if it happens to help the organism, then it is selected, but usually it doesn't. Well, now, unless God is guiding that, if God were guiding it, then it's not random. If God is not guiding it, then we have the same problem that you can get order, you can get apparent design out of some unguided process. So I don't see the advantage to saying in retrospect, you know, we can see the teleology coming out of it.
Yeah.
What do you say to somebody who says, well, in retrospect, we see that randomness can give rise to order, and you were mistaken in your premises in the first place? That so you can have, when you unexpectedly get something as magnificent as, you know, fingers and hands and so on, you can say two things. Well, clearly the amorphous stuff from which they came was not really amorphous. It was planned, or it was guided, or it was set up to produce these things. Or you can say, why, look, we got these things from something amorphous. Therefore, amorphous stuff can give rise to order. And the latter is what biologists routinely do these days.
No, and I'm agreeing that's a bad inference.
Yeah. Let me see if I can. Yeah. Just maybe.
To say that this change was unpredictable from like the prior structure and life of the organism, or even the substructure. Therefore, when it came out, it was random and unplanned. I think that's a bad inference, right? I agree wholeheartedly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that there can be, like, you can grant that, because I think what is or isn't random is relative to the kind of explanation that we're looking for, or that we could give given our first principles within a discipline, right? So I think you could grant it's random given the resources of biochemistry or something like that, and yet say in the biggest picture possible, it's not at all random.
Right. So, right. Yeah, let me, because I think maybe my, I guess, progress of a development of thought on this might help to clarify this question or this statement, right? So I moved away from naturalism to theism primarily because of the metaphysical arguments, right? And like evolution was just sort of this, it just didn't really factor into it, right? Because I became convinced that, yeah, in order to make sense of contingency, we need a purely actual reality. And so, like, whatever else I want to say about evolution and selection mutation, like, it seemed like, in principle, there is nothing out of bounds of God setting up different lines of causality that would lead to the development of life. Now, how he did that, I have no idea, right? But maybe if I just looked at the you know, biology itself, I wouldn't see those different lines of causality. So it might seem random from that perspective. But from the greater metaphysical perspective, it's really not random, right? That's kind of what you're saying, right, Jim? Mm-hmm. But then as I read Mike's work, I became convinced that no, actually, I don't know. I think there is a valid inference, you know, to be made in a sense. And I think maybe it connects to Aquinas' fifth way a little bit. And I just want to be very careful. And I got a little pushback in my conversation with Stephen Meyer, even just internally with myself, that I don't think what Meyer or Mike is doing, at least not what you intend to do, is like giving a an update on the five ways. I think these are different projects, right? But they share similarities because we would say Aquinas is really doing metaphysics, right? And that's sort of grounded in you know, some would argue in philosophy of nature. Mike, you're giving a really just a sort of an empirical argument against a scientific theory, but we can still have inferences from it. And one of those inferences is this, right? Is that if there's relationality, right? That is a hallmark of conceptual ideas. And conceptual ideas, of course, is the hallmark of a mind, right? Now that is exactly what Aquinas uses with his fifth way. Now you might say you can launch the fifth way from an electron, and you already said that, Mike, right? Just the directedness of an electron and final causality. One of the issues that people have with final causality is it seems like, forget an electron, take an oak tree, right? It seems like the oak tree is in some sense the cause of the acorn in its progression, right? But how is that the case if the oak tree doesn't yet exist, right? How can that really be a cause if it doesn't exist? And Aquinas' answer is it does exist in the mind of the prime thinker, right? And that's how he bases that. And it's all about the relationality and conceptual ability. Now that's, again, you know, a different argument in details, but I think there's enough similarity where you're saying, well, look, in these biological systems, we have relationality, right? And we have finality as well. Now, since it's not a metaphysical argument, maybe we can't get to pure actuality or the prime thinker, but it seems like we can at least get to conceptual ideas, which gives us intelligence from within the realm of biology itself. Do you think that's a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, I certainly do. And I agree with you folks that science cannot get to metaphysical truths or certainly can't argue to God as Thomas Aquinas did. But given the proper limits of science, I think ID is just what you would expect from a Thomistic perspective. That in fact, purpose, when we see bodies acting for a purpose or towards an end, we always realize that there is an intelligence behind that. And we see these, again, everywhere in biology. The one difference, I think, is that Thomas used simple examples like an archer or something falling down. He did talk about an oak and an oak tree, but that turned out to be more complicated than the archer and so on. But here's a question maybe you philosopher types could answer. If you see that there is intention or causality on one level, like say things falling down or archers shooting, does that automatically mean that everything is intended, everything that happens from that? For example, using the archer as an example, you know, the guy shoots arrows and they go here and there. Okay, well, okay, most of them hit the mark. But suppose the archer sent a number of arrows and it spelled out tantum ergo sacramentum, okay, on the wall. Could you say that there is another, could you conclude that beyond the archer shooting these, he intended for that phrase to appear on the wall? I think one can, of course. But the problem is, you know, suppose somebody else came along and said, well, look at the, you know, yeah, sure, he's intending that, but there's no evidence to show that he intended the higher order organization. He might have just intended to shoot the arrow, but not to make tantum ergo sacramentum. In the same way, you can talk about electrons and you talk about gravity, but does that entail that the things that they eventually do also were intended, also were guided or guided to the mark, like the archer? And if you don't, if you say that there are these other things can develop without intention, then it seems to me you're saying that chance can do a lot more than I think Thomas Aquinas would think. So the question is, at higher and higher levels of organization, suppose you had, a mark in the form of a letter T or something. Okay, well, yeah, that looks like it was designed, it's making a T. And you put an HE next to it. Did those letters arrange themselves by accident? And then it says the cat sat on the mat or something. Well, how about that? Is that organization of the sentence, is that intended beyond the words? And a paragraph, and then a book, and an encyclopedia. I think in our ordinary world, we recognize that each of those levels of design were intended for themselves, and they would not arise from the lower levels without intelligent input. And I think empirically, we can say the same thing now. Now that science has progressed, if we had turned out to be blobs of protoplasm, maybe we couldn't say that. But now that we have found how extraordinary is the cellular and molecular levels of life, I think we can, just like writing an encyclopedia is a further act of intelligence beyond just writing a sentence, I think we can say the same thing in biology.
That was Dr. Michael Behe talking with Pat Flynn and Jim Madden, the first of a three-part conversation hosted on Pat Flynn's YouTube channel and presented here by permission from Pat Flynn. For more great conversations on design and purpose, science and philosophy, stay tuned to ID the Future at idthefuture.com or follow us on your favorite podcast app. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.